I'm Brandi Cruz. Coming up today on Undivided, state workers are now joining Seattle teachers in demanding more of your money, even as both the Seattle Public School District and the state of Washington face budget crises. Plus, a mother accused of exposing her child to fentanyl is an example of yet another failure of progressive policies. And Detroit is paying kids to attend classes. Should we consider doing the same? That and much more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, you can support our show for just $5 a month by signing up at undividedpod.com. That's undividedpod.com. Click on the banner that says support the show. Hello, hello, and welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. I'm Brandi Cruz. I remember these days. Oh, summer is waning. Fall is beginning. It's a fresh scent in the air. You did your back-to-school shopping with your parents. You got your favorite outfit on. You're laying it on your bed. You're ready. You're ready for the start of a school year, which the largest school district in the state, parents and students, they're ready for the start of the new school year in Seattle, which begins tomorrow, and teachers are ready too, right?
What do we want?
A contract!
When do we want it?
Now!
What do we want?
A contract!
When do we want it?
Now!
No, of course, they're using students as political pawns, and as of right now, there is no indication that students in the Seattle Public School District are going to be heading back to class, because teachers, instead of starting negotiations in March when the school district wanted them to, waited and waited and waited until they could properly use students as leverage and back to school as leverage. And now they're saying, we want more money, even though the school district doesn't have it. So rather than being in classrooms teaching students, as parents really want them to, because they've made plans for it, teachers are going to be doing things like making signs, which they've been spending an awful lot of time doing, according to their social media, in the past week. And posing for pictures, of course, outside the schools that they will not be at inside teaching tomorrow. Here, teachers at Emerson Elementary School, some fists in the air. Yeah, you guys are awesome. Jane Addams Middle School, little peace signs in the front. I love the 20-something teachers posing like this. You can come to me. Peace. Aha. That's like what you do when you're out with your girlfriends and you're like, aha. And they're doing it outside of the school that they're going to be striking at and keeping your children out of school, which just seems a little tone deaf to me. So Seattle Education Association all over social media basically saying this is all the school district's fault. We enumerated yesterday why it's not the school district's fault, why these teachers are some of the highest paid in the nation, why some of the things they're saying they don't get, they actually do get, and they get paid on average more than $140,000 a year to work for 180 days. But one of the things that they were just posting about on Facebook strikes me as particularly odd, considering the situation the current president of the Seattle Teachers Union is in. Of course, you'll know that the president of the Seattle Teachers Union has been credibly accused by the school district of harming students. In fact, we even showed some pictures on the show yesterday of some of the bruising that one of these students allegedly endured at her hands. I think we have that image here. And at the same time that that's going on and that they refuse to comment on the alleged abuse perpetrated by the president of their union against, again, a special education student. She was also allegedly throwing books at the special ed kids, screaming at them until they cried, and then telling them she didn't care about their tears. And independent witnesses in the school would say that her special ed kids were so scared of her that they flinch when she walks by. Well, her union is posting on social media, talks broke down. There are no talks scheduled. The district continues to insist on special education cuts that would hurt kids. Ah, they're worried about the district's cuts to special education hurting kids. SEA has made it clear that we're here to bargain. We have spent hours trying to find a way forward for special education. We couldn't find a way to meet their interests without causing harm. Gee, I think the very best way not to cause harm and hurt kids in special education would be firing the teacher that is credibly accused of, I don't know, harming kids in special education, who is currently the president of your union. But they won't even comment on that. So that doesn't seem like they really care about the health and safety and well-being of special education kids in the district. They just care about money, which is what this is all about. So the superintendent of the Seattle Public School District, we talked about a letter he sent out to parents, long letter yesterday that was just unprecedented. You don't see a superintendent push back that hard against a union during a negotiating period, but he just had enough. He's like, they're out there spewing lies and nonsense on social media. They're claiming they don't get pay that they do get. And so we want to get our side out there. And he now says that during every day that this continues, he's going to have a press conference. He had one yesterday, and he just reminded the public, look, the school district is flat broke.
I will say, as everybody knows, we're broke. And so we have to be really thoughtful around how we can spend the money that we do have. Now, look, we do have $1.35 billion. I appreciate that. But almost all of that money is kind of already earmarked. And so the issue is, if we need to spend more money, where would we take it? And the last thing I want to do is to make schools worse in order to fund something else that maybe we didn't necessarily need.
And I'll also say, in the backdrop of all of this are the numbers we've shared with you ad nauseum on this show. But just to reiterate the point, or as PETA doesn't like to say, beat a dead horse. I mean, our expenses per pupil in the state of Washington have more than doubled in the last decade. It used to be around $8,000 per pupil. Now it's about $20,000 per pupil. That's happening as test scores have declined, and also as enrollment is going down and as attendance is going down. And so just as a practical matter, you know, you have fewer students. They're doing worse. You've doubled the amount per district per pupil. And teachers still want more money, and you're still in a budget crisis? None of that stuff makes sense. So I don't think that the Seattle Public School District is innocent in all of this either. I mean, this guy is fairly new. He seems pretty common sense. But schools, you know, are not, by and large, in the state of Washington, focused on their core responsibility of teaching kids. I think that is pretty clear. And then the unions are so powerful that they can just take to the picket line, keep kids out of school, and demand more and more money, even though they get paid quite a bit of money to work for 180 days. The superintendent says his priority is the kids, and he just wants the Seattle Education Association to do the right thing.
We are doing everything we can to focus on our children. If we can serve them food, we're going to serve them food. If we can have aftercare before care, we will try to do that too. If we can have programming for our kids, we're going to do that, because at the end of the day, that's my job, is to make sure that the schools are open as much as they can be, no matter what happens. But my hope, of course, is that we're open on Wednesday for full classes and full schools. And we say very clearly to SEA, please work with us so that that is the answer and that is where we can be.
Yeah, well, Wednesday is tomorrow, and there's no indication that there are even any talks scheduled between now and then, between the school district and the teachers union. The teachers union is busy just talking smack on social media, as the superintendent has pointed out, criticizing them using poop emojis. I mean, these are greedy, immature, ideological individuals. And I actually misstated it yesterday. I said like 70% of teachers voted to strike. It was actually 91% of teachers in the Seattle Public School District have voted to do this to families and kids. You can still continue to negotiate and make sure, if you really care about the kids, and I'll say this 100 times, if you really care about the kids, don't keep them out of class. I mean, especially, frankly, if I want to use your own buzzwords, in some of these communities of color and disenfranchised communities, you've got 12, 13, 14, 15, 16-year-olds out there shooting each other. Probably a good thing to get them off the streets for the summer and into a classroom, don't you think? Provide a little structure to their lives. But they don't care about that. They just care about maximum leverage. Today, for the teachers' union, represents maximum leverage. The school wanted to negotiate in March to prevent this from happening, but that provided no leverage for the teachers. So really, shame on them. None of what they're saying makes sense. They're losing in the court of public opinion. You should just do the right thing, let kids go back to school tomorrow, and make sure that parents don't have to come up with more parenting plans and hire and pay someone to watch their kids. It's just absolutely ridiculous. The teachers' unions are out of control, and it's not just the teachers' unions. So thousands of Washington State employees who are members of the Washington Federation for State Employees walked off the job yesterday. It was kind of symbolic because they walked out during their lunch hour, so I don't know if anybody actually noticed that they were gone, but they represent about 52,000 state government employees. That includes employees in higher education, public service workers, and what do they want? More money. When do they want it? Of course, right now. Despite the fact that Washington State is already just came out of and is now facing another historic budget deficit because our state is run by people who can't count, like can't do basic math, can't figure out basic economics, and wants to spend your money on everything under the sun, including laser hair removal and boob jobs for transgender prison inmates. So they just keep finding themselves, despite more and more taxes, in a deeper, deeper, deeper hole. So there's an October 1st deadline. It's actually set by state law that says you've got to ratify these new contracts by October 1st. And if you don't, I mean, they kind of can move forward, but then that ends up being a back pay situation. So they're walking out now to try to make a point. And I'm reading these, this is from the Washington State Standard. I'm reading some of these quotes from these state workers who were out, you know, waving signs during the walkout. And again, is it wrong that it just strikes me as whiny and entitled? Like, think of all the cuts the state of Washington is making to try to get its budget under control, all the new taxes, rather, that the state of Washington wants to put on you to get its budget under control. And these people are like, we need more money now. It says, with contract negotiations nearing a critical deadline, hundreds of Washington state workers walked off the job for an hour on Monday to highlight demands for wage hikes in their next two-year deal. Governor Bob Ferguson proposed state worker furloughs in 2025, but lawmakers shelved the idea after union backlash. Ashley Fustin, vice president of the WFSE, said, we're not going to agree to furloughs. We're not going to agree to cuts. We're not going to agree to takeaways. That's not acceptable. So they're just not going to agree to anything short of what they really, really want. It reminds me of the one spoiled, rotten character on Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. I want a golden goose, and I want it now. It's, again, as the state, you decided to work for state government. And by and large, it's a pretty secure job. Like, it's really, you get great benefits. Some of them get pensions. It's really hard to get fired as a state employee. But when you go to work for the government, just as when you go to work for the federal government, you know, federal employees, how often are they impacted by, you know, partial government shutdowns or funding lapses like what DHS went through? And the same thing when you work for state government, frankly, you are subject to situations like this where we're in a self-inflicted budget crisis and they're going to have to make cuts, or as they choose to do, not cut things, actually pass billions of dollars in new taxes. So they're going to take money from all of us when things are expensive as it is with inflation, the cost of gas, and you're going to force them to give it to you in higher pay right now? It's totally tone deaf. Let's see, Sam Brown, who has worked more than a decade with the State Department of Agriculture, said, I think they're just testing our unity. That's what it seems like to me. He says, several colleagues carpooled from their Tumwater office to attend the Olympia event. Ferguson, in response to the walkout, said, we're negotiating. I don't have anything else to add. So he just says that they're trying to negotiate in good faith ahead of October 1st. Here's what's interesting is these union folks are turning on him. They are turning on him. They don't like the beast that they created. One woman, Sierra Kiao, an accountant at the Department of Social and Health Services, said, I really have supported Bob in the past, but it feels so disappointing to be out here having to hold a sign like this. I didn't make it, but I hold it with pride. What a weird quote. I didn't make this sign, but I'm holding it with pride. Workers at both the Friday and Monday events suggested Ferguson was not living up to his commitments he made while campaigning. What we're fighting for is the opposite of what he ran for and promised us. Yeah, you know, this is what politicians do. They promise you the moon and the stars on the campaign trail, and then they always underdeliver. Well, in the vast majority of cases, they underdeliver. And of course he was trying to please unions and talk about things like growing the size of government, which is ultimately what he is doing. And you grow the size of government, you grow the size of government employees, and you grow the size of their salaries and their budgets and all of these things. And so, of course, they were going to vote for someone like Bob Ferguson over someone like Dave Reichert, because there was no way Dave Reichert would have grown the size of government. So big government is good for big government unions. But when they say, this isn't what we voted for, well, you know, none of us really wanted this, so maybe we have something in common, but I also didn't vote for him. And for their part, Brianna Ajo, who's a spokesperson for the governor's office, just real quick, she told the Standard, reiterated the budget crisis that the state is in. She said, in the past 18 months, we've tried to implement budget reductions, and then she blamed it on Trump. Gosh, she added the state is dealing with draconian cuts from the Trump administration. Gosh, everything is Trump's fault. It's not the fact that our state's spending has ballooned at like 9 times the rate of inflation and 3 times the rate of population growth, and we're spending money on a bunch of stuff we shouldn't spend money on. Not our fault. Can't look at our own house. We have to blame Donald Trump. I really worry for their mental health when Donald Trump's out of office and they can't actually reasonably blame him anymore. I think it's going to be just a breakdown because that's what they use for every single problem that comes up, is it's Trump's fault. So, yeah, they strike, it hurts us. You know, Washington state employees, if they decide that they want to push and try to use leverage to get more money, well, that money is going to come from us. Same for Seattle public school employees. Ultimately, their strike hurts kids. It hurts families. It'll ultimately hurt people living in the city of Seattle, whether you have kids or not, but they just don't care. All right, coming up next, more layoffs. Meanwhile, talking about economic issues. And if we think the current budget situation is bad, it's going to get a lot worse as all these big businesses cut jobs. And that is a cut into tax revenue. First, if you're a small to mid-sized landlord in the state of Washington, consider becoming a member of the Rental Housing Association of Washington. They serve a few functions. First, they're down in Olympia advocating on your behalf and for good housing policy and against some of the bad housing policy that we've seen in recent years. They can also help you on an individual basis. So if you're a landlord, you're having some trouble maybe keeping up with changing rules and regulations, or you're dealing with some crazy squatter situation, they can always, I don't think they engage in individual legal advice, but they can always help you navigate that process. And then they have events all year long talking about housing policies, state politics in general. I'm speaking at one coming up in just a few weeks. So Washington's trusted resource, empowering housing providers, rhawa.org, rhawa.org. Become a member today. All right, and the layoffs just keep coming. This segment is brought to you in partnership with our friends at Future 42. Turn your frustration into action at future42.org. Make sure you sign up for their newsletter to be alerted to opportunities to do just that. All right, more layoffs at Amazon. Also, some layoffs coming at the Great American Riverside Casino, which is apparently permanently closing. So there's like, gosh, about 250 jobs that will just no longer exist anymore, and that's in Tukwila. But in Amazon, they filed a notice with the Employment Security Department saying they are permanently laying off 121 workers. And by the looks of the list that they provide, which is required under state law, it looks like these are going to be factory workers, facility workers. And so this isn't like big Amazon executives who are fleeing the state anyway because of the income tax or anything like that. These are people who are working factory level jobs who are going to lose those jobs because of the state of Washington's poor business climate. And I really encourage you, and maybe, and this is a good way because it's like straight from the source, if you have friends or family members who are skeptical about just how dire the state's economic situation is and how these layoffs are ramping up, just send them the link to this notification portal for the Employment Security Department with Washington State, because that's the first place you're going to hear about the layoffs, because that's what law demands. And so they can just sit there and track the list of how many hundreds of jobs every single week are leaving Washington State, or how many businesses every single week are closing in Washington State. And I saw this news over the weekend, which at this moment, I can't definitively tie it to what's happening in Washington with the income tax proposal and capital gains and just the weakening business climate. But I'm not going to rule it out either. So if you look at the skyline of the city of Bellevue, which has just grown so much, it's exploded in the last couple decades, virtually everything you see is owned by one company, Kemper Development. It's a family company. It's been around for 80 years. And you'll probably recall that last year, Kemper Freeman Jr., who led the company, is 84 years old. He decided to retire last year. And I mean, what a legacy, really, when you can look up at the skyline and be like, that is what I built. And it has turned Bellevue into a hub for business, but also into a place where Seattle tech companies could flee to avoid the disastrous policies of the city of Seattle. But the truth is that Bellevue is now going to suffer the same fate as Seattle, because they can, on an island, have good business policies, but they can't escape the state policies. And so when you have the state of Washington doing similar things that Seattle has done, well, now Bellevue isn't going to get a choice in the matter. So I don't know. Maybe it's not a surprise that Kemper Development announced they are planning to explore the sale of their entire real estate portfolio, virtually the entire skyline in downtown Bellevue. So they're going to sell the Bellevue collection. They've begun exploring the potential sale. The family said it's in the early stages of the process. It's looking for a broker right now. They didn't disclose a specific reason for exploring the sale, and they haven't said what they're asking for it, which I imagine is going to be quite a bit. But just to give you a visual of what we're talking about here and what the Bellevue collection entails, it's 5.5 million square feet of portfolio. It includes Lincoln Square South, Lincoln Square North, Bellevue Place, the Hyatt Regency Bellevue, the Westin Bellevue, the W Bellevue, and across the street, Bellevue Square. And the fun Christmas stuff. What do they call that when they come in on Christmas? Snowflake Lane.
Snowflake Lane and Celebration
Lane. Which they have confirmed will continue this Christmas at least.
Okay.
But if they sell, it would depend on the new ownership, right? So let's do a further breakdown of what this all includes. So again, Bell Square, Lincoln Square, Bellevue Place, 2 Lincoln Tower, 400 Lincoln Square, also the future home of the Kids Quest Museum, which is about to open, 200 retailers, 50 restaurants, 30 cafes, 1.7 million square feet of office space, 3 hotels, 2 cinemas, and 12,000 parking spaces. They're going to sell it. Who do you think is going to buy it? You know, and I think who would they be willing to sell it to? And I'm not saying that there isn't some, you know, corporation in America that, you know, buys development stuff like this. But gosh, is there foreign government or something is going to get it? It's going to cost a lot of money. I also wonder if they're going to be able to get for it what they want to get for it, given sort of our declining reputation on the global stage in terms of our economy here. And I mean, honestly, when you look at Bellevue compared to Seattle, the Kemper Development Company has done a phenomenal job at making sure that Bellevue remains a place that's clean, relatively safe, certainly comparatively, that is enjoyable to visit. You go into Bellevue Square, which I do not infrequently, I maybe go once a month. Most shopping malls like that in America are decimated, are ghost towns. I mean, go to Pacific Place in Seattle, almost the entire thing is empty. Bellevue Square, no matter when you go, is popping off. They're opening new stores there all the time. It's always full, always busy. The restaurants, the stores, everything. In this climate, that's phenomenal. So again, I don't know that they're necessarily deciding to sell, like, let's cut and run, because at some point, this is going to go the way of Seattle and it's not going to be worth as much to sell. We are reaching out to them to inquire about how much the state's business climate has to do with that. There's also a question about whose hands it's going to go in. Is it going to be stewarded as well as Kemper Development has stewarded it? But look, I think that is very significant. It's probably the most significant economic headline that we've had in the state in several years. So we will see what happens there. Maybe Kemper Freeman will sit down with us and do a little interview about it. I mean, what a remarkable life and career and legacy that he's built and all of these things. So we've reached out to the company. We'll let you know what they have to say. And, you know, I'm hoping that there is a good buyer, you know, somebody who wants to buy it despite the economic outlook of the state. So it's a risky investment. That's what I would say. That segment is brought to you in partnership with our friends at Future 42. Turn your frustration into action at future42.org. Make sure you sign up for their newsletter to be alerted to opportunities to do just that. All right, coming up next in our segment, Unbelievable, another baby dead exposed to fentanyl in the state of Washington, and Democrats show no sign of wanting to solve the policy failures that led to it. First, a lot of investors right now focused on AI, crypto, tech, but is your money manager as focused on energy as they need to be right now? If you're not sure, reach out to our friend Zach Abraham of Bulwark Capital and get a free second opinion on your retirement portfolio. And I think that's just a smart thing for anyone to do. If you've had the same money manager for a while, you're not really sure what's going on, there is no harm in getting a second opinion. It's totally free. Bulwark Capital is focused on risk management. They're always looking for opportunities to lower risk, lower cost, give your retirement as much upside as possible. So why not get that second opinion? It's free. Schedule your Know Your Risk portfolio review today at knowyourriskpodcast.com. Plus, unlike other wealth management firms, you can get market updates every day from Zach Abraham on his Know Your Risk podcast, YouTube channel, all across social media platforms, and of course, here on weekly episodes of Swamp Watch. Just search Know Your Risk podcast, and of course, reach out to them for that second opinion on your retirement portfolio. And with that, let's get to our segment, Unbelievable. Okay, several years now, lawmakers in the state of Washington passed something called the Keeping Families Together Act, and neither side is free from blame in this. Republicans voted for it, Democrats voted for it. And the idea is, you know, you've got a huge substance abuse crisis in the state of Washington. And so what the law did is it sort of changed standards by which a judge could remove a child from a home where there was active substance abuse. Now, Republicans say they were hoodwinked on this, that they didn't really understand what the bill would become. To that, I say, well, you should have, because your job is to understand what the bill will, might become and the impacts of it before you vote on it. But now, to their credit, Republicans have realized that this has resulted in the state of Washington keeping kids in really dangerous situations where they are exposed to a deadly drug like fentanyl, where they're dying at a record rate. We're seeing numbers like we've never seen before. And that this idea of keeping families together is all well and good, but you can't keep a family together if the kid dies, right? That's sort of the opposite of keeping a family together. Or frankly, if the parent dies. So it's about getting the parent's help, but for the love of God, make sure the child is safe while the parent gets help. And then you've had, you know, Democrats like Representative Roger Goodman, who's the chair of the Public Safety Committee, who is standing by the Keeping Families Together Act. You'll probably remember this clip from a King 5 report where he sat down for an interview, and a lot of credit to this King 5 reporter. And he was just saying, like, oh, it's wrong to separate families, even if it means a kid's exposed to drugs.
In Olympia, bills to close this fentanyl gap haven't made it out of the House, specifically the Community Safety Committee.
And by criminalizing parents, we are separating parents from their children forever, and we don't want to see that.
Yeah, we don't want to see that. We don't want to criminalize parents. And so the state and the Department of Social and Health Services came up with, I mean, really a genius idea. I have an idea to keep these kids safe. Let's hand out taxpayer-funded lockboxes to these drug addicts so that they, I don't know, will have the presence of mind while they're high out of their mind on fentanyl, slumped over, to then turn around and lock that fentanyl up in a lockbox as if that would ever work. Here's the clip from King.
The King 5 investigators found early last year, DCYF started giving parents who use drugs like fentanyl lockboxes like this one. And the goal is to keep drugs out of reach so kids don't accidentally eat the pills or powder. But child welfare advocates say that these lockboxes do not account for the highly toxic nature of fentanyl.
Yeah, and they don't account for the fact that when you're high out of your mind on fentanyl, you're probably not thinking about your child's safety in the first place. Can we agree on that? Doing fentanyl in the home, doing some other sort of hard drug in the home, you already don't care about the safety of your child who's in that home. And so why would they care enough about the safety of their child to then turn around and lock those drugs up while they pass out in their drug-induced stupor? Well, I mean, of all the stupid government ideas, the free lockbox thing is about the dumbest, and it doesn't work. There are many examples of it not working. For instance, Davina Tanglin, 39 years old, had a lockbox. Guess what? Her baby still died. Her baby still died. Traces of fentanyl in his system. This was just on August 25th. She was arrested by the Seattle Police Department. Not only did her one-year-old baby die, she also had a two-year-old girl in the home. This is from the Seattle Police Report. Responding officer described Tanglin as appearing high or intoxicated. Tanglin's words were slurred, and she would often mumble. She had difficulty focusing on questions and would be easily sidetracked. Her eyelids were droopy, and she appeared as if she were going to fall asleep. When they talked, she stated, "I'm sorry. I effed up. It's all my fault." Tanglin relayed the following information to patrol officers. She was in the apartment with her son, the victim who died, a one-year-old baby, and her two-and-a-half-year-old daughter. Around 11 a.m., she took a nap on the sofa, holding her son. She woke up still holding him, but he was limp and not breathing. She stated that she suffers from fentanyl addiction and had a stash of fentanyl in the house. She said she normally keeps the drugs in her bathroom in a container on top of the counter, and she locks the bathroom door to keep the fentanyl safely away from her children. But she stated that when she woke up, she saw the lighter that she normally keeps with her drugs was on the couch, and she was concerned. So all of a sudden, she looks over, she sees, this is what she told police, that the door to the bathroom was not closed, was not locked, the door was open, the light was on. And she wakes up, and her one-year-old baby boy was dead in her arms. And she's like, well, that's weird. Usually, when I'm high out of my mind on fentanyl, I make sure that I'm not doing it around my kids and I'm responsible and I lock it up. Well, clearly not. He had fentanyl in his body. This is from the charging documents. She faces two counts of reckless endangerment, one count unlawful possession of a firearm in the first degree. More on that in a second. She's also under investigation for first degree manslaughter as they weigh the, you know, actual cause of death for his son, because there's a couple possibilities. Either he obviously got exposed to fentanyl in some form or fashion because it was in the toxicology report. But they're also looking at the possibility that maybe that exposure was secondary to his death and she actually smothered him by getting one of the fentanyl folds while she's holding her son and suffocating him to death, as if that's any better. So the state asked the court to impose bail at $200,000. It says at this time, the state is charging the defendant unlawful possession of a firearm, reckless endangerment, while they continue to look into the death of her son, who just, by the way, celebrated his one-year birthday, first birthday. It says the defendant admitted to recent fentanyl use and believed her son may have gotten a hold of her fentanyl, which resulted in his death. An autopsy was completed. Fentanyl was found in both his urine and blood. The toxicology lab will be completing a full analysis to determine the amount in his system, which could help them figure out, was it a lethal amount, which for a one-year-old baby would be virtually nothing, or did he actually get smothered to death by his mom, who was passed out from the fentanyl folds? It says, during the investigation related to the death of the child, officers executed a judicially signed search warrant on the defendant's home. During their search, they discovered a handgun and suspected narcotics. Both items were located in an unlocked space and accessible to the children. The 2.5-year-old can walk, and her mother indicated she also climbs up on furniture. Fortunately, the 2.5-year-old did not gain access to the guns or narcotics, but as demonstrated by the death of her brother, she was in an unsafe environment that could have resulted in her death. Very strange. Again, oh my gosh, but she had a plan. She had a box to lock the drugs in that was going to be safe. That's what the state of Washington says will fix all of this, right? Yeah, doesn't fix any of it. I guarantee if they do a toxicology report on the 2.5-year-old, who thankfully isn't dead, that they'll also find fentanyl residue in her urine and her blood. Because they're living around it. They're breathing it. They're touching surfaces with it on there. A drug that can kill an adult in a dose as small as a pinprick. And we've got a 1-year-old and a 2-year-old. A lockbox doesn't fix it. A lockbox doesn't keep them safe. A little bit more from the police report that just proves this idea against the Keeping Families Together Act. Like, all the things that they put in place, like, yeah, we'll keep the kids in the drug addict's house, but we'll have a safety plan. They came up with these safety plans to make sure that, like, there's any safe way for a child to be in a house where there's a drug like fentanyl around and being used. But look, a safety plan was implemented in this case. Didn't work. It says, social worker Shaney Lazvar advised me that Tanglin has been cooperating with the Department of Children and Youth and Families for the last year. So they say, oh yeah, she's cooperating. No big deal. The social worker tells them that on August 24th. However, back on August 5th, she tested positive for drugs. So how can you say she's been cooperating? She tested positive for drugs on August 5th, a couple weeks later. Her baby dies, fentanyl in his system. She tested positive for fentanyl. A safety plan was put into place at that time. So when she and the man living with her tested positive for drugs, both of them, he tested positive for cocaine, she tested positive for fentanyl. What did the state do? Not, hey, we got to get the kids out of here. Nope, the safety plan that they put into place was what? Did you give them a free lockbox? Was that your safety plan? Because guess what? Social worker for the state of Washington, your safety plan didn't work. Kid's dead. Kid's dead. Mom is facing probably decades in prison. They believe that they'll probably charge her with manslaughter in the first degree, which would probably be the appropriate charge. And by the way, that whole possession of a firearm thing, this Davina Tanglin, as long as we're talking about, what did Goodman say? Oh, these people don't understand what they're doing. Do we have that clip?
Many grieving parents, grandparents tell me it feels like the state is protecting the adult and the child who died is not getting justice, that their life does not matter. What do you say to that?
There have been so many tragic incidences with families and children exposed to these substances. If you're committing a crime, you need to know you're committing the crime. And so many of these people who are suffering from a severe substance use disorder have no idea what's going on. And the question that many of my colleagues have is, do we want to attach criminal liability to someone who is suffering from a substance use disorder, even if someone else may be harmed?
That's what the Democrat who chairs Washington's Public Safety Committee believes. That they're on drugs, they have a disorder, they don't know what they're doing. Do we want to attach criminal liability to that, even if someone else is harmed? You mean even if a baby's dead? So you don't believe that the mother should have criminal liability? And how long, Rep. Goodman, do we allow her to use that excuse? Because she has a criminal history dating back to 2001. She was committing crimes before 9/11. 2001, robbery in the second degree. Attempted robbery in the first degree. 2006, charged with possession of cocaine with intent to distribute. In 2013, she lost custody of a different child because she subjected that child to dangerous conditions. So she already got one kid taken away from her. And the state of Washington sees fit to allow her to what? Continue to have kids that she continues to subject to dangerous conditions? And we'll give her a safety plan, we'll give her this free lockbox, and we'll just send her on her way and just hope for the best. We'll hope for the best because she has a substance use disorder. She doesn't know that what she's doing is wrong. Apparently, she hasn't known that what she's doing has been wrong for the better part of 25 years. But this is about keeping families together, right? Well, now the baby's dead. The mom's still in jail. Probably going to go to prison for a long time. 2.5-year-old girl, Lord knows where she'll go, because she basically doesn't have a family anymore. So how's that for keeping families together? I would say your little law isn't working. So if you had any conscience whatsoever, this is the year that you would fix it before more kids die. Unbelievable. All right, we'll get to national news coming up next. First, we keep getting emails about undivided viewers and listeners who have taken the First Mark Challenge. Tara says, I switched my homeowners to First Mark, saved $1,600 a year, and I have far better coverage. Greg Porter says, hey, I did the First Mark Challenge, really easy and quick. They came back in 2 days telling me my policy was good and they couldn't improve on it for the price. They suggested a couple changes that weren't so costly, asked me to try back next year if rates change. Great service. And I love to hear both of those stories because I think that's the sign of an honest company. They really just want to do what's best for you. So in Tara's case, that meant better coverage with a $1,600 a year savings. And for Greg, that meant basically turning away his business and saying, hey, Greg, the best thing for you is to keep the insurance you already have because you have it at a pretty good price. So we love our friends at First Mark. I'm insured by First Mark. Nicole's insured by First Mark. Our business is insured through First Mark. And it's just exceptional service. When you need them, you pick up the phone and someone here in Washington State answers. And that's not service you're going to get from the major carriers. So what are you waiting for? Your savings could start tomorrow. FirstMarkInsurance.com. FirstMarkInsurance.com. The very best part is they work for you, not the insurance company. So they always have your best interest in mind. All right, some national news. Ron DeSantis. Flock is dead to him for now. So Ron DeSantis, you might recall on Florida Report last week, we talked about his frustration. We played this clip from him, his frustration with what he calls the misuse of Flock cameras.
I'm all about having law enforcement have tools to be able to hold criminals accountable. I think that's important that we do that. And no one's been stronger on law enforcement than me. But I don't want to have this become a surveillance state. I don't want there to be a situation. And that's why we wanted an AI Bill of Rights. Remember, we were pushing for that. And when I see like a police officer using this to track like an ex-girlfriend, I'm like, you know, what the hell's going on, you know, with this?
Yeah, and I don't really disagree with any of that. I've said, I just don't like the complaints, I guess, from the left. Like, I think there's a lot. There's a segment that's pro-criminal. They're just anti-cop anything. And, you know, they led the police defunding movement. You've got a city like Seattle that's short 700 cops, and these cameras have helped them in specific crime hotspots where they can be utilized in absence of patrol officers. But I do understand the concerns that DeSantis is laying out about it being a police state. Now, the example of, oh, a cop used it to track his girlfriend, like, yeah, then he should be fired. I don't know if you blame the cameras on the cop abusing the cameras. That seems stupid. It's like blaming the gun for a mass shooting. You blame the person who did it, right? So now this is what DeSantis is doing. Florida banning flock cameras and other license plate readers from state highways. DeSantis saying this is about preserving Floridian sovereignty and quality of life. And so they're revoking the ability of local police to put license plate readers on state highways. And this is really as there's sort of this national bipartisan backlash to specifically the flock camera system. And so the Florida Department of Transportation put out this memo to all agencies saying discontinuance of all future LPR placement requests. As of the date of this memo, the department will use its discretionary authority to cease the issuance of all future requests. So not only are they shutting them off for now, but this will also be future requests as well. They say there's been an exponential increase in deployments of this technology along the highways, coupled with concerning reports of misuse, data privacy concerns, and surveillance schemes. And they are going to look into all of this, essentially, and take a little more time to assess what's the best use of this sort of technology. And I don't really have an issue with that per se. I do know that the government's already surveilling us, so I want to kind of do away with this idea that getting rid of the flock cameras will somehow fix that little situation. Like, we're in too deep. I think it's perfectly healthy to be concerned about privacy. I know for me, flock cameras helped track down one of the Antifa radicals who assaulted me last June at an ICE facility. So I was very grateful. So how am I going to sit here when I was like, yay, thank you, flock, for helping to identify this person and celebrate that, but then be like, I don't want flock to be used to solve other people's crimes? Like, that would be a little bit disingenuous of me. I do believe there is a narrow use for these cameras, like the hotspots for crime in Seattle, where you need an eye on 3rd and Pine 24 hours a day. Ain't nothing good happening at 3rd and Pine. Like, you need to surveil it constantly. 12th and Jackson, same thing. So if you've got some areas where the only thing that happens there is criminal activity, I don't have an issue with that whatsoever. Do I want to be surveilled on the highway? Do I want them to utilize these cameras to give me speeding tickets? Hell no. Absolutely not. And then the issue is when you get the technology in place, now the infrastructure's there, it's paid for, and then it's much easier for the government to expand the uses, the accepted uses of that technology. So those are the roadblocks that we need to make sure are in place to protect all of us. So I don't hate what DeSantis is doing. Let's hit the brakes, figure out how to move forward. All right, as I mentioned, absenteeism is a huge issue in Washington State. It's been getting worse and worse with kids just not showing up to class. Seattle Public School District, it's quite a problem there as well. Now the teachers are forcing kids to miss school, which is interesting. So Detroit is trying something out that I wonder if you guys think is a good idea. So the Detroit Public Schools started what's called Perfect Attendance Pays Program. And this is something they've done before. They said they're going to continue to do because they say that there's been good results from it. So essentially, they use interest earned from district funds that are being held currently, so like bonds for facility projects, to pay to fight absenteeism. Here is a report from Fox 2 Detroit.
The district is once again offering its Perfect Attendance Pays program. That means that middle schoolers who get perfect attendance for a week will get a $50 gift card, and they could earn up to $500 if they attend every class that week on time. Now, high school students will get a $100 gift card for their perfect attendance for an entire week with a chance to make up to $1,000. And this whole idea is to increase enrollment and, of course, attendance at all Detroit public schools.
$1,000 for per week, which I think
$1,000 is the max, I think, for the
because what it says is middle school students who get perfect attendance for a week get a $50 gift card,
yes,
up to $500 if they attend every class that week on time. So it's almost like you can have perfect attendance if you just come to school, But then on top of that, if your perfect attendance includes getting to class every day on time, which isn't that, that's why insane. Isn't that part of it?
Wait, so they can make like $4,000 a month?
I guess. I mean, I don't know if there's a max or a cap to
it. I didn't like this before. I was thinking
it was... I didn't see any cap to it. Yeah, it says this program is for all K-12 students enrolled in public, charter, and private schools and is valid 7 days a week, year round. Oh, wait, that's something else.
Yeah,
sorry.
I actually think they can earn $100 for the perfect attendance for an entire week with a chance to make up to 1,000.
I don't read it that way. Yeah, we got to look into this more because it says high school students will earn a $100 gift card for their perfect attendance for an entire week with a chance to make up to $1,000 if they attend every class that week on time. So it's almost like you have attendance. You just get the $100 if you just show up to school. Show up to school on time. We'll give you up to $1,000. That's what it sounds like for me. But anyway, I asked you guys in our daily subscriber show poll if you agree with just the basic concept. Should schools with low attendance pay kids to show up? Because you think of, you know, what is the societal implications of them not showing up? Is it going to cost us more money in the long run as they suck off the government teetles? Nicole, what do you say?
No.
Okay.
I think it's absolutely ridiculous. This is why we have teachers striking. This is why we have government employees walking out, because they're all like, we deserve it. We deserve it. I don't know if your work deserves it. Some of your work might deserve it. Yeah. But like showing up, that's just half the battle. Like the work is what you should be getting paid for. Like I'll give you $50 for an A or something like that. But showing up is not the
job. You could show up
job.
And sleep. So yeah. I, as much as I was trying to play devil's advocate, yeah, of course I'm against this. because, yeah, it feeds into the entitled mentality that you get something for doing nothing or the bare minimum. That's the bare minimum. We're not going to pay you for doing the bare minimum. Now, I do agree that there are costs to society for students who don't get a proper education and maybe they're getting, you know, they're on the government teat later in life as a result. But I don't know how you measure that. And then what about for the kids who were already showing up?
I know, I got perfect attendance. Right. I worked really hard for that.
And so like the kids who were already showing up are going to get the same reward as the kids who needed to be bribed to show up.
Right.
That doesn't make a lot of sense. You guys are 90% no. Although I'm surprised it's not higher than that, to be frank. Let's see here. Over on Locals, Don's wife said there should be a maybe option. It might be a viable option in some school district, but it's a hard no regarding making it a policy across the whole educational system in the U.S. Just Sensible says, hell no. What happened to personal pride and accomplishment? Don't bribe with money. So they show up and get nothing out of it? Wrong message. Let's see. Matthew Cook, another example of the government being the parents on the taxpayer dime. Yeah, exactly. It's like, but then you're going to have these parents, you know, if you're already letting your kid skip school, I'm going to guess you're not a very involved or engaged parent. And then all of a sudden the parents are going to say, oh, you should go to school now because you can get money and give it to me. Like it is quite odd, isn't it?
And it is a max of $100 a week, $1,000 total. So that's
Okay. The story was written poorly.
It was.
And then the superintendent of the district says when they miss, talks about the justification. When they miss 18 or fewer days of school, they are 3 to 4 times more likely to be at or above grade level in literacy and math and college ready on the SAT. So we're going to do things better dramatically in the classroom to support our children. We have to have students there consistently so that we see that God-given talent come out on a daily basis. But still, I mean, bribing
them. You know what also would help
is
actually holding them accountable for their attendance. So if you are, I know someone who missed 48 days of school and they still graduated. So maybe that shouldn't be a thing.
Yeah.
Like make them accountable for the time that they spend at school.
Yeah, they don't get in trouble for bad behavior. They don't get in trouble for low test scores. Oh, we can't fail kids who show up.
And that kid is not doing great right now because he was not taught to be responsible for his actions.
Andy says, how about fining the parents $50 every time their kid doesn't show up?
Not a bad idea.
Not a bad idea. I like that.
They should pay the kids the due.
Yeah. Yes. Just.
But I do think that, I mean, is that interest should be used for what the, I mean, that's taxpayer money.
For, right.
So taxpayers have paid that into it. It's making interest. That's part of the plan.
Use it for tutors or something to help kids who are falling behind or something like that. So it just really is outrageous.
Yeah.
All right, we'll get to comments from the live stream coming up next. First, you know the saying, save it for a rainy day? Don't do that when it comes to replacing your roof. Because if you need a new roof and you save that for a rainy day, well, too late, isn't it? So a couple things. First, fall storms just around the corner. Contractor schedules are filling up fast. So if a new roof has been on your to-do list, don't risk another wet fall and winter. Call Valentine Roofing now. They still have priority scheduling available where they can get your new roof project started in as little as 3 weeks. In about an hour, you'll get a fair estimate, honest upfront pricing before the seasonal demand picks up. And I would do the same thing even if you're not sure. If you don't know if your roof is on its last legs, if you maybe have a leak or something, the leak could be repaired. It might be time for a new roof. Just have our friends at Valentine come out. And every project includes the Valentine experience. Seamless communication, meticulous cleanup, extra mile service, flexible financing options, all the things. Call 206 Roofing today. Get started within 3 weeks. That's 206 Roofing. And remember to tell them that you heard about them right here on Undivided with me, Brandi Cruz. All right. Comments from the live stream on the school superintendent saying, we're broke. I love him. We're broke.
We're broke.
It's not a joke. Stacy says, it's all about the SEIU. The more money the teachers make, the more money the union receives. Well, SEIU is not the teachers union. That's WEA. So you might have switched them there. But yes, big government, SEIU benefits from that as well.
Mm-hmm. MAMS, Make America Make Sense Again, says they knew they wanted more money when their vacation started 3 months ago.
Well, they knew before that.
They knew before that.
The district tried to start negotiating in March.
They always
and they
want
didn't
more
say
money.
Anything for months. Mm-hmm. Looking up for Jesus, you should get a property tax holiday as long as these educators are on strike. Yeah, you strike, we're not paying property taxes. Deduct that from our overall bill. Mm-hmm. Thousands of state employees staging a walkout. Baron of Gray Matter, $5 super chat, Nicole.
How much is it? 1 billion. 1 million seconds equals 11 days, 1 billion seconds, 33 years, $1 per second for 33 years. People don't understand this.
I don't understand how much money that actually is.
Yeah,
John Shoemade, proof again that public workers think you work for them, not vice versa. Yeah, 100%. Mm-hmm. On the layoffs.
Yeah, Sean says Amazon is installing more and more huge robots to do the job. So they that's why they're making cuts.
And why wouldn't they when the state has made it so expensive to hire people and to create jobs? I mean, that is pushing them toward these AI advancements. On Kemper Development looking to sell Graham Robbins, you'd have an easier time selling a truckload of, you'd have an easier time selling a truckload of cigarettes to a lung cancer survivor than selling Bellevue Square to a prospective investor with the current business tax climate here in Washington. Yeah, I don't know. It is an interesting time for them to choose to sell, in my opinion. I'm not privy to the behind the scenes of it, but it seems like Washington State is on the decline.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, maybe they're trying to get out now before it gets worse, I guess.
Yeah. But
maybe... you know who I could see taking advantage of it going
China?
Down? No, Trump. wouldn't that be great
if
Bellevue
if
got
Trump
taken over
it,
by the Trumps?
And then everything said Trump Square, the Trump collection. Oh, no.
That'd be so fun.
Oh, my gosh. There would be riots in the streets.
That'd be fun.
Watermelon Shug. Oh, gosh. I hope the new owners maintain how nice everything is. Yeah, that's my concern is like, it's really nice over there.
There's obviously
a
business model that's working. So,
yeah, like you have to care.
Weisskassel says, wonder if it's connected to fears that Washington State's credit rating is about to crater.
You know, I think that's connected to broader economic fears, right? On the lockbox that just forgot to lock itself, letting the fentanyl out to kill a baby. Just horrible what these lockboxes will do these days. Mm-hmm. R.M. Colm says, toxic families provide nothing good to children. Yeah, and look, I bet that mom, if the state wants her to get better, I bet she'd have a much easier time focusing on herself if she didn't have two babies in the house. That probably makes it a lot more difficult to be able to focus on her own sobriety. And so, yeah, separating families for a little bit, I think, is best for everyone involved.
Right. Yeah, I mean, taking a nap, well, you have one kid in your hand. And what was the two-year-old doing during that nap?
Right. It wasn't a nap, Nicole.
It wasn't a nap.
It wasn't a nap. She was passed out on fentanyl.
Craftogram and Crispy says, by not criminalizing parents, they are killing children and they're okay with
it. They're okay with that. That's what Roger Goodman said, basically.
Yeah. And
it's a sacrificial lamb.
The smothering thing, we've heard from several foster parents that have said that this is something that is not getting reported accurately because it is often labeled SIDS or whatever. But it's often getting called SIDS when really it's a lot
smothering.
Of smothering and it's a lot of Because you passed out on your child. Out on your kid.
So we'll see exactly. It'll come down to the toxicology, how high the levels of fentanyl were and all these things. But either way, she's culpable for it, right? Mm-hmm. All right, Grego, I'm going to call this bill what it is. Democrats, let kids die, don't give a damn act. As a foster parent, this is totally unacceptable. There are plenty of good people that will gladly give these kids the love and life they deserve. Sorry, this really pisses me off. You should be pissed off.
Yeah.
And it's frankly sad that lawmakers on one side of the aisle aren't as pissed off as you. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're the ones down there who can do something about this. And they think it's perfectly fine. As I said, Roger Goodman thinks the kids, you know, if you have to die in order for your parent just to be able to work through what they're going through, then so be it. Unfit for
and again,
office.
I think this is an 80-20. This is, I mean, I don't even think one. It's maybe 99-1 because... I don't talk to anybody that's like, yeah, it's important to give kids back to drug addicted parents.
No, it's
nobody
so
says
bizarre.
That, so I don't know where this comes from in there.
We get these like ideologues are the ones that want to run for office.
Yeah.
And then they're in there and it's just outrageous. It's crazy. On DeSantis ordering the removal of flock cameras for now, Kathy Hall, we need a governor in Washington state like Ron DeSantis, one with a good head on him who knows what the heck he's doing. That's what we need in Washington.
I don't know if I agree with this one. I don't think it's necessary to remove them. I don't think we should be removing the flock cameras. I think that they are doing more good than the potential harm that they could have right now. Now, if you want to set up laws to protect, fine. If you want to punish people who abuse, fine. Yeah. But they are doing much more good than harm.
But and like the state highways, for instance, what would be really the purpose? I guess you can track cars that you're trying to like
multiple
chase,
and,
right?
And kidnapping, things like that. And tracking down these people. I know that the ICE, like heaven forbid ICE gets a hold of it, that's like their main concern, but I just think that they're what are you worried about? Like, you worried they're gonna track you as you go get your kids from school? You worried about you go to
it's a slippery a doctor's slope idea though.
I get it,
yeah,
but like let's not let it get there, put in all these barriers, put in these these things, but they're not listening to you. I mean, you let things listen to you every day. It's not the flock cameras.
Yeah.
So if you would like to ban something, maybe Amazon Alexa is your problem. Sorry.
Yeah, I never got into those. I didn't like the idea of that in the house. But yeah, like let's only use them for active criminal investigations.
Yes.
So if you have an active criminal investigation and you need to look at the footage and you get footage and only use the portions that are relevant to that active criminal investigation, I guess I don't see the problem with that.
But. And yeah, I am more concerned about the red light cameras and speed cameras.
Yeah, those are just annoying. Those are a moneymaker.
Yeah.
Get a life. All right. Thank you, Nicole.
Yeah.
We'll get to our closing sanity check coming up next. First, our friend Wes Jones at sellwithwes.com. Sellwithwes.com is the guy you want to talk to if you're thinking about selling your home. Wes says he's got a lot of people reaching out to him because of that new millionaire's tax, which is just an income tax, and they see what's coming, that it's going to be an income tax on everyone.
Many people believe, as you do, as do I, that it is going to be an income tax for everyone. And believe it or not, the vast majority of the people that I work with, they're actually not going to be impacted by the millionaire's tax. But what they are impacted in is just the cost of living that we are in. And they could be people who are my generation with families. They could be people who are getting ready to retire. And they just see the writing on the wall that it is very, very expensive to live here. They see where the future is headed. And they are making the decision to eject now because this is not going to be the place for them to raise their family or the place for them to retire affordably.
Yeah, so if that sounds like you, Wes has worked with a ton of people in your exact same situation, thinking about leaving the state, but worried about the housing market right now and whether you can get the amount of money for your house that you want to get out of it. This is what Wes specializes in. He's been through all the market ups and downs. He's been doing this for a really long time. They have a marketing strategy in place to make sure your listing stands out. Take a look at his website. Take a look at the listings that have recently sold, and you'll see exactly what I mean. Sellwithwes.com, sellwithwes.com. It really just is a better way to sell your home. And with that, let's get to our closing sanity check. All right, so there was a hearing in Congress on sanctuary policies today, including, you know, this latest sort of controversy over the CDL, the commercial truck drivers who are illegal aliens getting CDLs without being able to properly speak English. And Democrats think it's just so racist to take the CDLs away from them. But they heard today, including Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, who's on the committee, and who Marcus Coleman was speaking directly to. He is the father of Delilah Coleman. In June of 2024, she was 5 years old. She was severely injured. She was hit by a tractor trailer driven by an illegal alien. This happened in California. So Marcus Coleman, looking directly at Congressman Jayapal, among other members of Congress, had this to say.
How are you guys not fighting for this? Right here, how are you guys not fighting for this? I reject your guys' sympathy, to be honest with you. There's no way you guys are sorry. Not one of you guys have ever called me. Not one of you guys have ever reached out to me. Not one of you guys have ever sat there and seen me in the hallways and said, hey, sorry about your daughter. You guys do it right here while you guys are grandstanding on top of your soapbox. This is when you guys care. Right here inside this room is the only time you guys care. I've never received anything from anybody over here at all regarding my daughter or my family or anything. Hey, Mr. Coleman, your guys' Delilah law, I want to help you revise it so that we were interested inside of it. Nothing. You guys have no pathway to anything. You guys want to sit there and talk about the pathway to citizenship. There is a pathway. It's not jump the fence and apply. That's not the way it goes. There's a process to get it done. You don't just do that. I can't just go over there and go sit down inside one of those seats and become a Democrat. Oh, you know what? I probably could. I honestly probably could. So I'm not even going to say that. But I can't go inside a hospital and become a doctor just because I want to and go put on a coat and come to work. It's getting ridiculous the way things are going now. It honestly is. It makes no sense at all. Sanctuary cities allow so much to be done that it's almost like the parents not there to take care of the household. And everybody's running around and doing what they want to do. And it sucks. It honestly does. You guys sit there and you guys talk about ICE invading cities and doing this and doing that. I agree with Mr. Jordan, that if the state sat there and told them, come pick up the person, it would take one or two people to go do it. Instead, they got to send an army out there because now they have to look for them. And then since it's a sanctuary state, you got people sitting there abusing the ICE officers that are out there. I have a whole statement right here that I was going to read to you guys, but just listening to you guys, none of this is relevant anymore because you guys just changed so much. It makes no sense at all. My daughter doesn't deserve this. She didn't ask for any of this. The people that jumped the fence did, though. They knew exactly what they were doing. They still chose to move forward in that direction. And every day something's happening to somebody. And it is your guys' fault. I hold each and every one of you responsible for it. And I always will.
Wow. Goosebumps. Again, his daughter, Delilah. Delilah's law is named after her. She's permanently disabled. She will never be the same. And that is the law that seeks to crack down on the issuance of these CDLs to illegal aliens, which, as he so eloquently and emotionally pointed out, should never happen, makes no sense. And members of Congress are the ones with the power to fix it. That has been our closing sanity check. That has been today's episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. I'm Brandi Cruz. She's Nicole Thompson. What else? If you'd like to support our show, go to undividedpod.com, undividedpod.com. Click on the banner that says support the show. In the meantime, we'll be back here. Why are you laughing?
I wish I could see you already brushing your hair.
I don't know why. I started brushing my hair as soon as I went off camera. Why do I do this?
I don't know.
Why do I have a hairbrushing obsession? I had it when I was a kid, too. It's something mental. Anyway, you got to do what Marsha did. If I don't brush it 1,000 times a day,
okay,
it doesn't stay shiny and beautiful.
And shiny. Okay.
Anyway, just look at her snitching on me. I didn't want people to know. Now I had to tell everybody about my mental disorder. This has been today's episode. See you tomorrow. Same time, same place.